Welcome to the latest edition of Web Sleuths Radio. My name is Tricia Griffith, and this week we welcome back author and journalist Caitlin Rother. Caitlin is at the Rebecca Zahow wrongful death civil trial, and she reports what happened last week and what we have to look forward to. I welcome Caitlin back, and we got right to it.
Caitlin, welcome back, and thank you for joining us. You're helping us tremendously with your insight into the case. Thank you.
Oh, well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it, and I'm happy to be here.
Caitlin, before we get into the meat and potatoes of this week's testimony, let's go over who has testified so far and where we stand as far as what's going to happen next week.
Okay, great. Well, we've been in court for 10 days now, and so far all but one day has been the plaintiff's case. That's the Zahow family, represented by Keith Greer. Yesterday was day 10, and it was actually out of order. So because we were going to originally have, when I say we, I just mean we, in general, the public, we're going to have Adam Shachnai testifying on the, as a plaintiff's witness. They weren't ready for him yet, so they put him off until Monday, and that meant they had to take the defense's first witness out of order, and that was Detective Angela Tsuda. So I'm going to go back to the very beginning, and I'm going to kind of just mention everybody who's testified so far for the plaintiff side, which is going to finish presenting its case with Adam Shachnai on Monday. I don't know if it'll take more than one day, but that's what they're planning. So we started out with, this is 2 weeks ago, so it was Wednesday, Thursday, and then Monday through Thursday for two more weeks. So we're, you know, just at the end of week three. Started with Mary, I may get these slightly out of order here, but I think I have them in the right order. Coronado officer who responded first to a 911 call when Max Shachnai, the six-year-old boy of Jonah Shachnai, that would be the nephew of Adam Shachnai, who's on trial. He had reportedly fallen 12 to 14 feet, and it was scooter versus chandelier, you know, and fell and was and had a heart attack as well, which was kind of lost on me initially, but has been reinforced. Very kind of bizarre injuries, which didn't get explained really until this week, with a deposition by one of the doctors, video deposition, so he wasn't actually in court. Next came a PERT psychologist. I forget what that stands for, but it's psychiatric something or other. They ride around with the officers in case they have mental health issues or if they're people needing assistance. She happened to be there. It wasn't a mental health call, but she happened to be there, and so she did end up talking with Rebecca. And she was able to testify about her state of mind. No, she did not seem suicidal or depressed. Next came Mary Zahow Lohner. I think that's how you pronounce her last name. She's married to a police officer, actually, in Missouri. She sits at the plaintiff's table with Keith Greer, the attorney. So she testified. She is Rebecca's oldest sister. Then came Rebecca's mother, Perry, I'm not sure he pronounced that, Zahow, who was, I think I mentioned last time, just devastated, sobbing, could not stop crying, difficult to understand her because she has an accent and she didn't understand English very well. I think it's her third language, something like that. But she did testify about what kind of person and relationship she had with Rebecca. As a Christian, you know, she really helped out her mom financially and emotionally, and she was just a really good girl and her favorite daughter, it sounds like. So it was very sad. Next came Lisa DeMeo. She is what she calls herself a forensic specialist. So she was a blood and fingerprint expert, basically talking about that evidence. And she introduced, I mean, it was introduced in the opening statement, but she talked more about a knife that was found, a steak knife. So picture a steak knife with a thin handle with blood and other, what she called biological material or something like that. I can't remember exactly. She had some kind of vague term for it. because Rebecca was in her menstrual cycle, and so that was the only source of blood that anyone found. So she wasn't bleeding from her. She didn't have any cuts. She was bleeding from her period, and so there was blood up 2 out of 3 rivets on this handle. And so Keith Greer said in his opening that that represented a sexual assault with whoever must have. Well, they interpreted that to be that someone inserted that knife into her before she died. So that came up yesterday, and we can talk more about that when I get to yesterday's testimony.
Okay.
And also talked about fingerprints in a pretty kind of awkward position on the blade of a chef's knife, which was also found on the floor in the bedroom where the loop went around the bed to where she was hung. So, and she testified, and she stood there with the knife behind her, and they had another expert do the same thing in order to get her fingers to match the prints that Rebecca had on the blade. She said the only way she could figure out how that could even work was to hold it behind her back as if she were with the blade facing the rope, essentially, as if she were trying to free herself. So that was pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Then there was a handwriting analyst who talked about the message that was on the door, painted on the door. She saved him. Can you save her? No punctuation, all in capital letters. And what I thought was most curious about that was, I think we may have mentioned this last time, Adam Shacknife's signature is in capital letters. Now, I've never really seen somebody sign their name using capital letters, but he does. And the witness, to be fair, said that's not the first time he's ever seen it. It's not completely rare. It's rare, but it's unusual, but it's not unheard of. So I guess there are other people who do that too, but I thought that was curious. He went on all day, and the defense really took him apart for not looking at all these other letters that they thought he could have looked at and compared, but he only used 2 letters out of that message to compare Rebecca and Adam's and the door, and he said it was more likely than not that Adam wrote that message than Rebecca. DNA expert testified next, and then she came back, so she testified twice, but not 2 days in a row, and she basically talked about how there were a lot of surfaces that were appeared to have been wiped clean because there was no DNA in places where you'd expect to see it. Either no DNA or in many places insufficient DNA, but again, none matching Adam's, so he was excluded, and there was Rebecca's DNA on the rope in other places, so that was established. And then a knot expert, forensic knot analyst, testified about these knots that were binding her wrists, her neck, and her ankles. And he says that the reenactment video that the sheriffs put together showing how a woman could tie herself up with her wrist in front of her and then slip her hand out, put it behind her, and then put her hand back into it to match what they said were the bindings that they found on her when she was found, you know, after Adam cut her down and called 911.
Mm-hmm.
So there's been quite some argument about this. But they showed that video again yesterday twice. But the knot expert said those are not in the video. He said those are not the knots in the recreation video that he saw on the body because they were able, because it was loose enough on the body to get them off and preserve the knots. They put them on 2 empty cardboard tubes. He was able to take a look at the knots. Both in pictures before they were taken off her and preserved on those 2 cardboard tubes. And he said those were not the same knots. He said that the way that they tied them in the video was different he demonstrated his version of the knots in court, and I thought it looked pretty complicated and much more complicated actually than when the woman did it in the video. So I'm not an odd expert. I can only see what I see as a layperson, but all I can tell you is either version, I wouldn't have had the slightest idea how to do that.
Got it, yeah.
So,
I know what you mean.
And what we learned yesterday when the detective testified, which I thought was interesting while I'm on this topic, she said, oh, we thought they were really simple knots. It was just a slip knot in all three places. And the other expert was like, no, it's this kind of knot and this kind of knot and this kind of knot. And it's the totality of all these what seem to be simple knots together, very complicated. You would have to know what you were doing in order for these to work because there was a purpose to those knots, and, you know, in making them tighter when you were hanging so that you can't get out of them, you know, to secure her in them and to keep her, to make the noose tighten, et cetera. So, and she said, yeah, our sergeant just recognized them right off the bat. And, you know, we had the model who was a DOJ agent who was working kind of embedded, I guess, at the Sheriff's Department. We had her practice, you know, five or six times before the video, but because we wanted to make sure that they were accurate, that the defense attorney kept trying to say, is it because you thought they were complicated or simple? And he kept getting Greer's objections kept getting sustained, so he wasn't allowed to ask the question that way. But the way the Sheriff's Department made it sound is that they were simple and could easily be recreated. And the knot expert, who took 35 minutes just to describe his experience as a knot expert, literally 35 minutes because I watched the clock, he said they were really complicated. So, you know, that's pretty different testimony.
Yes.
Next came, let's see, then we had the mannequin incident, which I'll just briefly talk about. This is when the jury wasn't in the courtroom. The plaintiff's side wants to use this mannequin, and they are actually going to use this mannequin. They've been given permission, even though the defense objected and objected again, saying that the injuries and abrasions and contusions and bruises and whatever else on the mannequin don't match the pictures of Rebecca's body. And the testimony so far by some of these experts are no, it's just the angle of the photo makes it look like they're in a different place. You need to use landmarks on the body, not the way the angle of the camera is looking. So the judge let it be used on Monday for demonstrative purposes, so they will have the mannequin. But it was just very dramatic because the mannequin is so lifelike when Greer was manipulating the legs to form a 90-degree angle with the legs up from the to the ankles so that the expert could tie the knots around the ankles, et cetera. They had to completely cover the body in a sheet. And when he picked her up, it was like he was still – you could still tell how heavy it was because they tried to get it to be similar to the actual body. And it was just so lifelike. Their toenails were painted red, just like
I was going to say, weren't the toenails painted? I saw that, and that kind of freaked me out a little bit.
I just gasped. Honestly, if the jury wasn't there, so it's not like I was going to get in trouble, but I just was like, oh, my God, that's just so creepy because it looked just like a body.
Yes.
You know, and you would just start imagining what – I try not to do this because I don't know how I would do my job if I went there. So I tried not to imagine, but I couldn't help but imagine that actually being Rebecca, you know. So it was very disturbing. Anyway, and then we got some depositions, video depositions from Rebecca's youngest sister, who was there when Max fell in the house, and then they sent her home. And she testified about the 911 call when Max had his fall. And then Jonah Shackney's ex-wife, Dina Shackney, who was originally named in this case, along with Adam, who has since been dismissed, she talked about the time in the hospital with Jonah, things that Jonah said about Rebecca after she was found hanging, you know, by her brother, and what he said. Now, this was curious, and I mentioned this on the TV segment last night, because they asked me, you know, what do you think the family will be happy, even if it's just found to be murder, even if they don't find Adam, you know, guilty or however, you know, in court, it's not guilty. It's a finding for the plaintiff, essentially. But if they find him responsible or whatever.
Yeah, responsible.
If they don't find him responsible, do you think the family will still take that as a victory, or, you know, even with all this stuff coming out? And I said, so I'm coming back to this video where Dina said Jonah came back to the room. He was very upset, and she said, you know, why? Why do you think she did this? And he said, Asian honor. And so, mm-hmm. so I looked that up. I looked that term up, and, you know, it's, I think it really refers to the harikiri, you know, killing yourself.
Right.
Stabbing yourself in the stomach. But he's using it in this case, and he said, essentially, and that's all he said. He didn't explain
mm-hmm.
it. So I'm trying to put my own interpretation on what I think he meant by that, and that is she did that because she felt that she was responsible for Max's death. And so that's pretty much what the sheriff's department, I think, took to be their theory. That she committed
Correct.
Suicide
because
yeah. she felt guilty. Because he claims, and this comes back to the testimony from yesterday again, he claims he left her a voicemail at 12:48 a.m. That's 6 hours before she was found, and left a voicemail. Her phone shows that somebody checked the voicemail and then listened to the voicemail
mm-hmm.
and then deleted, well, we don't know if they listened to it because the voicemail has been deleted, and that was
right.
also discussed in court yesterday where Greer was saying, did you do any fingerprint analysis? How do you know it was Rebecca's phone? Well, because
mm-hmm.
that was the number we had. And how do you know that she's the one who answered the phone? You know, how do you know she wasn't bound and gagged, essentially, at that time? And they said, well, we didn't do fingerprint analysis. Well, how do you know it was, you know, how do you know Adam Shack
mm-hmm.
and I, you know, didn't answer the phone? We didn't do fingerprint analysis. Well, how do you know it wasn't Adam? Well, because he said he wasn't there. And he said, oh, so you just believed him? So
mm-hmm.
I thought that was a good moment for
right.
the plaintiff's side, a point on the plaintiff's side that they didn't, I mean, they exclude, he was initially, I'm kind of jumping ahead, I'm going to go back and forth, but that's okay, because this
sure.
is the way to do it. They basically just took his word for it, but the detective said, you know, he was initially a person of interest, and that's how we treated him.
Mm-hmm.
And so he voluntarily submitted, you know, fingernails, scrapings, I think swabs for DNA,
mm-hmm.
clothing, I believe, and he cooperated. But I thought it was also curious that we found out yesterday, I didn't know this, that the search warrant wasn't served in the guest house where he had, you know, allegedly spent the night.
Right.
It was a separate building. Also, we also got to see a layout of the whole property yesterday, which I hadn't seen before.
Mm-hmm.
I came into this completely open-minded, completely blank slate. All I knew was just from reading some news articles. So I kind of wanted it that way so I could learn everything fresh, just like everybody else in
Correct.
Court. Saw
right.
the diagram of the whole property. The guest house is actually an entire building. You think of a guest house maybe as a small thing in the back. No, this is
mm-hmm.
a big building. This is
a nice house.
Mansion with, I believe that was probably the servants' quarters originally.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was another building next to that, which again is not the main house. And so anyway, he stayed in that house. And that they didn't serve the search warrant and search that guest house for until like 6-something p.m. that night. He called 911 at 6:47,
mm-hmm.
I think, a.m. So who knows what happened to whatever evidence was in that house all day. I mean, I know
mm-hmm.
the police did respond, to be fair. The police did respond right away, Coronado PD, and they did secure the area. But I'm just saying, you know, I don't know. They searched the main house first. They didn't search the guest house, as far as I know.
Mm-hmm.
They were trying to secure the property, the main house, because she was found in the courtyard hanging from the balcony in the main house. So anyway, I'm just saying that seems like just a question mark.
So what you're saying
time.
Is there was enough time, you can assume that there was enough time if this happened the way the plaintiffs say.
Right.
There was
right.
enough time for Adam to dispose of whatever he needed to dispose of. Is that the indication that they want people
I'm,
to
I'm not.
Him?
I'm not blaming anybody on that point
right.
figures.
No,
I'm
I mean,
just
that,
saying that's a long time to
right.
not search an area after, I think. I mean, it's not as
oh,
bad
yeah.
as waiting 3 days, but,
mm-hmm.
you know, it wasn't right away. So And like I said, it's a big property. So mm-hmm. Where was I? Let's see. I'm back. I'm trying to go through this list here. Okay, so that's Dina's deposition. Then we get to the next week, and we had Cyril Wecht. So Dr. Cyril Wecht flew in. He was pretty entertaining.
Cyril Wecht is
the
best.
I swear he must be 90 years old. I don't know. Do you know how old he is?
I think he's like 82.
I don't know. I couldn't tell. He seemed to have a tremendous amount of experience. I mean, he listed off all these different degrees and jobs and cases. And Greer asked him about, you know, some of the cases he'd worked on, but he didn't answer these. I think what he wanted him to say was, you know, I think he was on the Kennedy assassination, right?
Yes, he was.
He told me in the hallway that he had worked on the, or at least consulted maybe on the Manson case.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a long time ago. That's in the, you know,
in the 60s. Yeah, he has been around a long time and very, very well respected. And he came across, I think, very well Monday on the stand. But anyway, go ahead. Tell us about his testimony. I'm interested to hear what the defense asked him, how they handled him.
Okay, let me go back into my memory here. Basically, let me just say what he said, and then I'll do the cross.
Okay.
He talked about what he thought of what happened to Rebecca, and he said he thought it was a homicide. Thought it was she was manually strangled before she was hung. He said he also thought that she was hit four times with a blunt force object, rendering her diminished consciousness or completely unconscious, which basically would leave her rendered helpless to fight back, essentially. And he said, you know, he did the second autopsy, and he wasn't able to see those injuries to her head until you peel back the scalp. And he said what he pointed out was she has this long, dark hair, which they didn't shave in the first autopsy. He said there were a different color. He talked about the injuries that he could look at the color and said that they were not post-mortem because of the color. So she was still alive when whoever hit her over the head, you know. And because I think the medical examiner or the sheriff's department, whatever, thought, and I might be wrong on this too because it didn't come out yesterday and I haven't read the actual autopsy report, but my understanding from his testimony was, it sounded like the sheriff's department thought that these injuries must have come when she was hanging and hit against things. So,
hitting things, right.
But so his testimony and then the testimony of the guy the next day, James Kent, who was the kinesiologist, biomechanics expert, these kind of go in tandem, so I can go back and answer your question about cross in a minute. But he was saying, you know, there were no injuries. James Kent said there were no injuries on the front of her. So, yeah, if she did hit the cactus as she was going down, that would explain the marks, the bruises and scrapes and cuts on her back. But there was nothing on the front. And so that kind of matched what Cyril Wecht was saying because he said, you know, she went over head first regardless of how she got over it, by herself or if someone put her over the side.
Right.
She went head first. And then you have to picture her going head first and sort of her body turning and flattening. And oscillating, swirling around, spinning around from the force of however this works, and then writing herself down so her feet are down, right? So she would have turned completely upside down, and that's a process, a spinning motion and slowly turning. And in that process, she, number one, would, if she put herself over herself, she would have had abrasions on her thighs, which she didn't, and she should have had, regardless, she should have had other injuries on her on the front of her body because she'd still be hitting things as she's spinning around. And she didn't have any marks, a significant enough damage marks on her shoulders, he said, because she would have been hitting things with her shoulders too. Not her head, her shoulders.
Her shoulders.
And that's so he said he didn't think those marks on her head were from that either. And then he said also that he thought the force of going over 9 feet would have caused more damage to the neck, more, and, you know, broken spine, you know, mm-hmm. and or damage to the spine. And so, and Sarawak said some of the same things, that, you know, again, the injuries to the neck, and they both cited studies, outside studies and literature, that they gave all these names to the cartilages, you know, cricoid, mm-hmm. I can't remember them all, I'm not a doctor, so, mm-hmm. but the cricoid cartilage is the one that they were focusing most on, that's the one that, since that was broken, that's why they thought she was manually strangled.
Strangled, right.
First, and not hung, because the mark on her neck where the rope was high, above mm-hmm. the cricoid, the broken, fractured, cricoid cartilage. So anyway, so on cross-examination from Sarawak, basically they, the defense said, okay, so they went through and said, okay, well, you know, you changed from what you said previously, which was that the manner of death was asphyxiation by hanging. And, you know, now you're saying it was, and that the cause of death was undetermined. Now you're mm-hmm. saying it was, you know, strangulation, and that it was a homicide. Because mm-hmm. you had a choice. You were given a form to check, and you had a choice of undetermined suicide or murder, and you said undetermined. And so now you're saying murder. And so they tried to, you know, talk to him about, you know, you were on Dr. Phil, they paid for your expenses, mm-hmm. you know, they put up a letter that where he had been from Greer saying, you know, thank you for agreeing to testify. Here's a $5,000 retainer. So the defense was characterizing that as you were paid to give an opinion on the stand that agreed with their case.
Right.
And so he said, I am highly offended by that, counsel. And, you know, he really came back at him. You know, I'm highly offended by this. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's not at all what happened. And that's not how I work. And they kept saying, well, did you interview any of the law enforcement people? Did you talk to this person? Did you talk to that mm-hmm. person? He said, I would never do that. That's unethical. I would never. So they were trying to make it seem like he didn't do a thorough enough analysis. And he was coming back saying, that's not how this works. We don't
right.
do that. I am paid as a consultant by this team. And unless they give me direct instructions to call mm-hmm. those people, I would never do that. And it's just
right.
not—it's not ethical. And they did the same thing with James Kent,
mm-hmm.
and he said the same thing. So basically, because he, you know, Dr. Wecht changed his, you know, conclusions. They
mm-hmm.
were trying to paint this as, you know, you're a paid expert, you're paid to come here and
right
and. He let him have it.
Yeah, you don't accuse Sarawak of anything unethical. He will come back at you, and that's, again, in his 80s, he still is as sharper than me than anybody I know, you know?
Then we had video depositions. Now, this was a really interesting day. So James Kent, let me just briefly finish with him. The next day, he said he thought it was more likely than not that she did not go over that balcony by her own volition, that
mm-hmm.
it was more likely that she was, you know, because she would have been decapitated or much more damaged with more and different injuries than she actually had. So, again, I'm back to the same premise that we are missing information. This is a very
yes.
mysterious case because we keep hearing about how the injuries – And this came out then in the depositions that I'm just about to describe. This came out again in Max's case as well, that the doctor who testified, Dr. Peterson, Bradley Peterson from Rady Children's Hospital here in San Diego, who had little Maxie come in, he said, you know, he was down for 30 minutes with being resuscitated.
Mm-hmm.
He's dead at the scene, and they resuscitated him. But that's a really, you know, that's a very poor prognosis.
Yes.
For anybody that, you know, in some cases, some hospitals won't even try to treat
mm-hmm.
somebody who's been down for that long. But his injuries did not match what we were being told, essentially, and the imaging that
mm-hmm.
we did. So, in other words, He does not know. He had a heart attack. He's a six-year-old having a heart attack. And he said,
that is bizarre.
Why did he stop breathing? We still, to this day, it's a very perplexing case to this day,
mm-hmm.
that the physical test that we took, he had no neck injuries. He had no injuries to his back, and his heart seemed fine and was working fine. But he ended up dying, I guess, from and being brain dead. Not dying, but being brain dead.
Mm-hmm.
He was declared, I think, brain dead the day Rebecca was found. So,
right.
According to Jonah, the voicemail that he left for Rebecca was that Maxie was brain dead and that he would never walk or talk again.
Mm-hmm.
And whoever answered her phone 2 minutes later to check her voicemail supposedly heard that message and then
mm-hmm.
deleted it. And so that's what the sheriff says. That's why she committed suicide, is she thought she was responsible because she was home at the time and wasn't with him, and he fell. So
mm-hmm.
this doctor is now saying, you know, but these injuries don't match what, you know, what we're being told, that he
right.
you know, supposedly fell 12 to 14 feet. But again, same thing as Rebecca, you know,
mm-hmm.
her injuries don't seem to match what we're being told either. So, you know, I got to
yeah.
tell you, there's stuff we just don't know, and I don't think it's going to come out in court. I said that last week.
Mm-hmm.
There's stuff about this case that's just funky. That's all I can say.
And there's nothing we can put together.
Up.
Right.
Regardless of whether, you know, are there other people involved that we don't know about? Are there
mm-hmm.
other circumstances we're not being told about? I mean, it raises just more and more questions every day that I hear these people testify. Now, and then there was another surprise that came out even before we get to yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
Rebecca had a boyfriend while she
oh.
was still married, before she was with Jonah, I believe,
mm-hmm.
and didn't tell him that she was married. She met him at a health fair or something. They started seeing each other, but she lived
mm-hmm.
in Temecula, which is in one county, and he lived in Glendale, which is, I think, Temecula's Riverside County. I don't know if you know California at all. And this boyfriend lived in Glendale, which is in the San Fernando Valley in Los Angeles County. And so they saw each other kind of long distance, and then he came to find out that she was married. He says, well, why didn't you tell me that? And so
mm-hmm.
she says, well, I'm going through a divorce. You know, he's been emotionally abusive, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, she finally moves in with him, and I think this is about 6 months, over a period of 6 months. And one day she goes off to work, and then she doesn't come home. And so he gets concerned. He calls work, finds out she never got to work,
mm-hmm.
goes to the police, reports her missing, because she starts calling him. And she's like, you know, basically, I've been kidnapped. I don't know where I am. I don't know who, you know.
Oh, wow.
He wouldn't give any answers. Yeah, all this crazy stuff is coming out. I'm like, oh, my God, what is going on?
I don't remember hearing that. That's
I know,
wild.
Me neither. So,
wow.
She was kidnapped, but yet she would call him, you know, two or three times a day, highly distressed and upset. And then finally, after a few days, she called, and it sounded like she was reading something. I cannot
mm-hmm.
see you anymore. I just cannot see you anymore. And then she'd say, ow, stop that. So, like, he thought, well,
somebody was
hurting her. Somebody's made
right.
her read some kind of statement to me. And then she came, you know, and the police went ahead and called her cell phone, and they told him, well, she says she's fine.
Well, that is bizarre.
What? That's totally bizarre. Yeah. So she finally comes back. She's on foot. She had left in her own car.
Mm-hmm.
He saw the car, and it matched what she told him, which was that her ex-husband, who this abusive guy,
mm-hmm.
took a baseball bat and smashed her window and took her with two other men and put her in a van or something and was driving
oh,
her around for several
God.
Days. Yeah, so she comes back. He's like, we're going to the police. She's like, no, we can't go to the police. He goes, we're going to the police. So he takes her down to the police station. The police take her into a room to talk to her for about 45 minutes, and then they say, well, you can go. And he's like, no, I want to talk to you. They're like, no, we don't need to talk to you. You can go. So,
wow.
So she was scared of her ex-husband, clearly.
Right. Right.
And then she says, well, I have to go. I have to get some time and some space. I love you. I want to be with you, but I need some time. So she
mm-hmm.
says, I'm going to Portland. So she goes to Portland. She calls him. I want to be with you. I love you, but I still need more time. Goes to Colorado, calls him. I love you, you know, blah, blah, blah. But I guess they never got back together. And as far as he knew, she never got back with her husband, during this deposition, they said to him, are you aware that when she called you in Portland and Colorado that she was with her husband? He said, no, I didn't know that. I wasn't aware.
Oh, my God. So it just
sounds
like...
Yeah, so the whole thing, but there's like all these other mysterious players who are starting to come out in this story.
Right.
So my head is spinning with what happened here.
Yes.
And this is all even before she met Jonah, but just to kind of get the background of everything she's dealing with. Her parents, I guess, were pressuring her to get back with the family. That's what she told him, to get back with the husband, because this had been an arranged marriage back in Nepal.
Mm-hmm.
Her sister apparently had been pressuring her. That's what she told him. I don't know whether that's true. And so that's what we learned from his deposition.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was another deposition from a woman who lived two doors down from the Shacknai Mansion. And she said she heard somebody cry out, help, help. And then she changed her story. By the time she got the deposition, it was, help me, help me.
Oh, dear.
She was 79 years old, I think, by the time she was supposed to testify this week. She said she was unavailable. I have fibromyalgia. The judge even called her on the phone without the jury being present to get a sense of her state of mind. She just sounded so stressed out. She's like, couldn't make it. I just can't do it. I'm in so much pain.
Aww.
And I'm crying all the time, and it's just so sad. Is it this case that's upsetting you? No, I'm just in pain. I'm just have fibromyalgia. I keep going to the doctor, but he can't, not doing anything. He's giving me these drugs. They're making me sick. I can't come in. So they basically played her police interview to impeach her, because she said, you know, she heard this and at this time, and then at another time she said she heard it a different time, and, you know, there were boys outside playing and making sounds that, no, they weren't at this time.
Mm-hmm.
She was a little bit all over the place. She claimed she heard help, help. She thought it came from the mansion, but then she told the police she thought it was from the sidewalk.
Mm-hmm.
So they basically, the suicide conclusion, they basically just dismissed this woman, I guess, as not credible because they could not corroborate her story with any other neighbor.
No. Okay.
But fact of the matter was she did hear this. Anyway, so then we get to yesterday. I know it took a long time to get there.
That's okay.
But we have covered some of it already. So
yes, we've
basically
got lots
just quickly.
About.
Just quickly. So the detective kind of went through some of the different factors that they looked at. The defense kind of led her through. And the attorney who's handling this is David Ellsberg. He's from New York, from a separate firm from the two other attorneys sitting at the defense table. So they've got three attorneys, and I'm kind of curious about this.
Mm-hmm.
If you hired one firm, why do you bring in another litigator from another firm?
Right.
To work with these other people. So I don't know what the relationship is. I mean, they seem to be working well together. I'm not questioning it from a professional standpoint. They're doing a good job. I'm just wondering, you know.
Why?
It seems like a pretty much of a powerhouse team as it is. With the one firm. But anyway, this guy is doing a lot of the defense work. So they kind of went, and he was very calm and seemed very, you know, compared to the other witnesses who, when he's been doing cross, you know, this is his witness.
Mm-hmm.
He was very much more laid back, very aware of what he was doing, I think. But just, you know, other days he seemed frustrated and the judge wouldn't let him do something. But in this case, you know, he was leading the witness through these various factors. Basically, he just led her through the investigative reports. You know, you got there at this time, you know, you did the search warrant, here's who on your team, you had 30 people, right, who helped with this investigation, you worked how many weeks on it, and she said 4 to 6. They kind of just, you know, led everybody through how they put the information together, and this was the first time that we got to hear what was on our phone. I have been wanting to hear this from day one. They would not talk about this to the media at all.
Mm-hmm.
So she said there were these two notes, documents in Word, I guess, or something, like a Word document on her phone. One of them, they put them up on the screen. One of them appeared to be a letter that she had written to Jonah. And I'm guessing these are letters. These are the ones you write for yourself, like a journal that you don't ever send because you're upset.
Right, a memo type thing. Right.
You know, and that is actually a reputable counseling tool that I'm aware of that counselors mm-hmm. will actually tell you to do. You know,
yes.
write letters to people. You don't need to send them. Well, mm-hmm. maybe it's better you don't. Just
exactly.
to get it all out, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's what it seemed like she was doing. So, you know, one was a note to Jonah, I think, is what it sounded like, basically expressing frustration that he was taking his daughter's, his 15-year-old daughter's side too much, who was being disrespectful to Rebecca.
Mm-hmm.
And that was also corroborated by her sister and other people who she had issues with this teenage girl from his first marriage. And she was feeling disrespected. She was feeling he was not really, you know, backing her up. And
mm-hmm.
She was upset about that. And the next note, I couldn't really tell who it was to, but it was like, well, I know he loves me, but – so it wasn't to Jonah.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know who it was to in particular, but just to get her thoughts out, I guess.
Right.
Again, you know, both of his ex-wives, they hate me, and, you know, there's no amount of money that is worth what I'm going through. I'm reading you some quotes. If I'm thinking,
uh-huh.
I'm crying. You know, basically that she felt like she was being treated as a worthless person, that's in quotes.
Mm-hmm.
She wasn't sleeping. So anyway, the detective went through those two notes and said, you know, this showed her state of mind that we felt she was suicidal. So that all, you know, seemed fine. And then Greer went on cross. So, and he was talking pretty fast. He was jumping around a lot. But he hammered on her. And what I likened it to was essentially you have a table.
Mm-hmm.
This is a table that has 10 legs, though, not four.
Okay.
Maybe a table with 10 legs, and one at a time, he basically removed the legs from the table
mm-hmm.
that represented the conclusion of suicide. So,
and how did he do that? What did he say?
So he started out with, you know, okay, so her loss of weight. You thought she lost a lot of weight. Why did you think that? Well, you know,
mm-hmm.
we talked to her sister, said that she lost a lot of weight. Okay, well, so then he went through the actual evidence and showed the driver's license, which showed that she was, 105 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
When he questioned the detective, she said, I thought, you know, when we talked to the sister who hadn't seen her in 7 months, she had weighed 120, and so when she died, she weighed 100. So that was, you know, 20 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
But he proved that it wasn't that much.
Yeah,
I don't know what the date
quick.
On the driver's license was, but basically
mm-hmm.
he just said, okay, so 20 pounds you think shows suicide. What about 5 pounds? Does that
mm-hmm.
still show someone to you that you think is suicidal? And she basically had to kind of acknowledge that, well, that was just one factor. We know there
mm-hmm.
was a totality of evidence. You know, we didn't just look at just one or two factors. Okay, so what about this child molestation thing that you mentioned?
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah, well, we were told that, you know, I don't remember what witness it – I don't remember who told us this, if it was a witness or her ex-husband, but that she was molested several times as a child.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so then he puts up this other piece of evidence, which quotes Mary, saying – Mary, the sister who's at the plaintiff's table.
Right.
Mary saying that, oh, we've talked about this, we laughed about this, it didn't affect us, and it was only one time.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, you know, well, so now we have this. And again, she said, well, it was just one or two, you know, we didn't look at just one or two factors. So
mm-hmm.
every point he'd bring up, that would be her answer. Then
mm-hmm.
she notes, okay, so you think this shows that somebody has committed suicide. Isn't this, you know, could this also just be someone who's coping, using this
mm-hmm.
as a coping mechanism? Anyway, so that was another point. And then
mm-hmm.
the religious beliefs. Okay, so did you factor in the religious beliefs and, you know.
Being Catholic,
and,
that suicide
well,
wasn't an option to them.
She was Christian, though, so I'm not
mm-hmm.
sure the Catholic. I
okay.
know what you're saying, but I'm not
right. –
he didn't mention that specifically, but that's what I thought of. You know,
mm-hmm.
if you are Catholic and you commit suicide, you're supposedly not allowed to go to heaven, right?
Right.
So he said, though, this is different. This is a different take that I thought was really interesting. Greer, as he's questioning the detective, he also brought up, did you consider religious beliefs as you're putting together your conclusions that Rebecca Zahau committed suicide? And she said, yes. So, well, you know, basically – he said, let's talk about this note. She saved him. Can you save her?
Mm-hmm.
What was your theory about what that meant? And she said, well, there are a lot of theories. You know, we sat around and basically brainstormed about this. But what was the – okay, so what was the theory that you came up with? And what was the one you settled on? Basically, that she was talking – that Rebecca wrote the note and that she
mm-hmm.
was talking about God being,
mm-hmm.
being you.
Right.
And so he said, do you think she's a religious person? Do you think she's the kind of person who would talk about God in that way?
Mm-hmm.
And that she would refer to herself in the third person? Did you look at her any of her other writings?
And mm-hmm.
did she refer that she would ever refer to herself as she? So I think he kind of knocked that one down too.
That's interesting because that is huge, I would think, because that's kind of the crux here is whoever wrote that is
right.
the one responsible. And
right.
How was her demeanor on the stand? Was she starting to get a little anxious? Did she hold her own? How did that come across, do you think?
Well, she was pretty calm throughout, and she just kept repeating. You know, it wasn't just one or two factors. It was
mm-hmm.
in totality. She even said, I don't mean to sound like a broken record, but I think she was probably coached by
mm-hmm.
county council on here are the things that you say. If you get stuck, here's what you say. She also said that would be in a number of cases, that would be a better question for so-and-so, you know,
mm-hmm.
from the crime lab. You know, I'm not a scientist. We relied on scientists to give us that certain information. We're not all experts in
mm-hmm.
these things. We have our basic expertise in different things, and that's why we make these decisions as a team. So that's how she responded. She
mm-hmm.
didn't, you know, she didn't crack. She didn't get upset. She didn't fight back. She was very level headed and
mm-hmm.
she held her own, but she did not take accountability for some of these things. And I mean, when she started, Keith Greer is basically saying, you know, did you have to bend over backwards to save face in order to, you know, keep the sheriff's department conclusion here? And that's, you know, he was being pretty antagonistic,
right?
You know, and argument,
right?
There was objections, but you know how lawyers do that sort of thing.
Oh yes,
points with the jury, even though they know the judge won't allow the question, and both sides were doing that.
Mm-hmm.
So
gotcha.
And
okay.
then basically, you know, he went into the theme in this case, which is the DNA that seems to be missing.
Mm-hmm.
Why wasn't there, you know, DNA, or why is there insufficient DNA to have any kind of finding on the paintbrush, two paintbrushes,
mm-hmm.
The knife that Adam used to cut Rebecca down? There's none of his DNA on it. So then back on redirect, the defense said, well, that knife was left in the sun, right? And even the plaintiff's expert said that DNA can degrade in the sun, right? That's another thing. They left the body and the knife and some of the other evidence in the sun all day. So who's, you know, that's now a theory of why some of this DNA might be missing, you know?
Oh, okay. That, yeah, well, that
but
could
there's
be.
Also
but
there's no DNA on this big paint tube, which
mm-hmm.
Was supposedly held and squeezed in order to get the paint out to write
mm-hmm.
this message on the door. So you would think that whoever was writing the thing on the door had to squeeze that thing. Why isn't that person's DNA? There's
it
no Rebecca DNA on it either, by the way.
Right.
So
right.
there's only one of her fingerprints on the very top of the cap, and there's one fingerprint, I guess, on the paint tube, but it didn't match hers, or
mm-hmm.
was it conclusive? I don't know.
So did they bring up the point? Did Keith Group bring up the point? Could it have been wiped down, or was that even brought up?
Yeah, he did talk about the wipe down, but again, she was doing the well. That would be a better question for our technicians. Every time he'd ask a question like that, that's how she
mm-hmm.
would respond. So
got it. Okay.
But you know, again, it did raise the point. You know, you're the lead detective. You know, you had to look at some of these things, but he would hammer and say, well, you know, is it of any concern to you that this DNA is missing and these fingerprints are missing? And she
mm-hmm.
just kept saying, well, it wasn't one or two points. And then he goes, well, how about 6 or 10 of these points? Would that concern you yet? Are you concerned yet? Are you concerned
Oh, wow.
yet? As he went through it.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought it was very – I thought he was very effective in, you know, basically showing the holes. You know, like they didn't look at the handwriting, for example. She said that on the stand
mm-hmm.
yesterday. She said one of our, you know, our criminalists say we need to have like to compare with like, and we couldn't find any anything that, you know, she had painted with block letters to compare it to, so we just didn't consider that.
Mm-hmm.
And meanwhile, we had a whole day of the handwriting expert for the plaintiff's side, who said, you know, he had a whole way of looking at that he discussed.
And so it seems like, and this is just my opinion, but it appears that is the tactic that the defense is going to use is, you know, there was no DNA, there was no physical evidence. Sounds like they're just going to pound that home. And I believe that's what Mr. Greer said he felt they were going to try and do, is just pound that home. There was no DNA.
Right.
How couldn't the DNA be on the rope? How couldn't the DNA? Well, now it sounds like if they left it out in the sun, perhaps it did degrade, and that would be a reason why his DNA wasn't on it. But who knows?
Right.
So it will be very interesting to see. It's going to come down to totality, the total amount of coincidences or unexplained things, as opposed to, is it going to matter more that there was no physical evidence? You know, it's no evidence itself. And I don't know.
Yeah, we'll have to see. I'm really curious to hear what Adam Shachnai is going to say, because I'm seeing a lot of evidence from his paid experts. They are paid experts, though.
Mm-hmm.
That there are things that don't make sense, and that are things missing, and that point to murder, right?
Mm-hmm.
But they have not really had specific evidence that points specifically to Adam.
Can the jury find that it was murder, but they can find that they can't say it was Adam? Is that something that they can say?
I believe so. I don't know for sure, but I think that might be one of the things that could happen. Yes.
That could happen.
You know, is that enough to get the case reopened? I don't know. I think that's what they're hoping. I think that's what they're hoping for, at the very least.
Yeah, and
I don't know for sure, because I haven't really asked them that formally. I'm just guessing.
Right. Well, it will be interesting to see. And listen, you've spent a lot of time with us today. I really appreciate it. And I want everybody to go to your website, CaitlinRother.com. I've got it on Web Sleuth in the How discussion.
Mm-hmm.
So we will talk to you next week and Monday.
One more place too.
Absolutely.
I've been giving daily updates on my Facebook page.
It's
public. I don't do this on my website. So the best place actually to go, if you want to buy books and look at what I've written, my 12 books, that's a great place to go, is the website. But if you want to hear more about this case on a daily basis, or if you want to know more about my other books and other updates like that, my Facebook, my personal Facebook page is public. You can follow me there. And I also have an author page on Facebook where I do post, but not as often, just because the Facebook algorithms don't let people see it unless you pay to boost it and all that stuff. So I do put stuff on there, you know, like links to this podcast, for example, will be on there and that sort of thing. So
fantastic. So just go to Facebook, look up Caitlin Rother, it rhymes with author, R-O-T-H-E-R, and we'll have you'll have updates there every day. That's fantastic. We'll definitely link to that as well. So, Caitlin, thank you so much. Enjoy your weekend, and
we'll be
talking to you next week. It's going to be a very interesting week. Take care
now. Sounds great. Thank you so much. All right.
You bet. Bye-bye.
Don't forget, this upcoming week is going to be big in the courtroom with the Rebecca Zahow wrongful death civil trial, and we'll find out. Adam takes the stand on Monday, Adam Shachnai, the one that the plaintiffs are accusing of murdering Rebecca Zahow. Okay, everybody, we'll see you on Web Sleuths, websleuths.com, that is. Take care, be safe, and see you in a few days. Bye-bye.